לתשומת ליבכם, התוכנית הבאה היא תוכנית מוקלטת, ועשויות להישמע במהלכה התראות והתייחסות לאירועים ביטחוניים שהראו בזמן שידורה הראשון. האזנה טובה.
You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Monday, April the 1st, 2024, in the headlines. A strike attributed to Israel near the Iranian embassy in Damascus kills several people, including a top Iranian Quds Force commander. An IDF soldier killed in battle in the southern Gaza Strip brings the Israeli military war fallen to 600. The IDF concludes a Shifa hospital operation after killing or arresting hundreds of terror operatives. An armed drone apparently launched from Iraq infiltrates Israeli airspace, hitting and lightly damaging a building in the Eilat Bay area. The Knesset passes the so-called Al Jazeera law, allowing closure of foreign media outlets deemed harmful to state security. And the yeshiva draft row spurs protests on both sides of the controversy. The weather outlook cooler along the coast and the coastal plain, but still hot for the time of year. Good evening. This is Nomi Segal with the news. We open with the reports from Damascus that a top Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander was one of at least five people killed in an airstrike blamed on Israel on the Iranian consulate building in the center of the Syrian capital. The building struck is adjacent to the Iranian embassy in Syria and is used as a military command center for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force. A Syrian opposition-linked organization, the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, said that among the fatalities was a senior figure from Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Reports have identified him as Mohammad Raza Zahidi, the Quds Force commander in Syria and Lebanon. An Iranian report also said his deputy was killed. The Iranian ambassador to Syria said that Tehran's response to the strike would be harsh. He claimed Israeli stealth fighter aircraft fired six missiles at the building and five to seven people were killed in the strike. Syria's foreign minister came to the site and also blamed Israel for the attack. The alleged strike comes days after dozens of Syrian soldiers and several members of Hezbollah were killed in a strike near the northern Syrian city of Aleppo that was also blamed on Israel. Earlier in the north today, Israel Air Force fighter jets carried out simultaneous strikes on some 10 Hezbollah sites in South Lebanon. The IDF spokesperson said the targets hit included a weapons storehouse, launch sites, and terror infrastructure. The IDF chief of staff, meanwhile, has authorized the plan for the continued fighting in the northern arena. The IDF spokesperson said Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi held a situation assessment in the Northern Command today with the head of the IDF Northern Command and members of the IDF General Staff. Staff Sergeant Nadav Cohen, a 20-year-old resident of Haifa who served in the 77th Battalion of the 7th Brigade, was killed in action in the southern Gaza Strip. Cohen is the IDF's 600th fatality in the war so far. Last night, the IDF spokesperson's office announced the death of First Sergeant Sivan Weil, a 20-year-old resident of Ranana who served in the IDF Egoz unit. Weil was also killed in action in the southern Gaza Strip. He succumbed yesterday to injuries he sustained in a rocket-propelled grenade attack last week. IDF troops have left Shifa Hospital in Gaza City after concluding a two-week operation there. Local residents reportedly removed 50 bodies from the compound following the IDF's withdrawal. According to the IDF, more than 500 Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists were arrested in the course of the Shifa Hospital operation, and more than 200 terrorists were killed. Palestinians who entered the hospital last night said they discovered the extensive damage that had been caused by the fighting on the premises. A number of buildings were damaged and Palestinians found bodies who they said were a large number of terrorists who had been killed. Military officials said that Shifa Hospital would not revert to functioning as a hospital, adding that it had been severely damaged as a result of Hamas's decision to turn it into a military command post. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant says the terror base was destroyed in Shifa Hospital. He praised the IDF and Shin Bet forces for their determined and quality operations and said the campaign came as a surprise to Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists. Hundreds of terrorists were eliminated or apprehended, and the interrogation of those detained has brought us closer to bringing down Hamas and made clear the organization is collapsing from within, he wrote on the social media platform X. Meanwhile, in the south, a hostile drone loaded with explosives launched last night from Iraq penetrated Israeli airspace via Jordan and struck an Israeli Navy building in the Gulf of Eilat. There were no injuries, though the drone damaged the roof of the building. A Khan reporter says the IDF is investigating how the drone managed to evade Israeli air defenses and strike a military installation without being intercepted. Air raid sirens were sounded in the city and its environs shortly before the incident. A pro-Iranian militia in Iraq earlier claimed to have attacked a vital facility in Israeli territory. Three ships carrying some 400 tons of food aid are approaching Gaza's shores. This is a second shipment that set sail from Larnaca in Cyprus as part of an international maritime aid corridor. The Cypriot foreign minister said the boats received authorization to begin unloading their cargo. Earlier, Juan Camilo, a representative of the relief organization World Central Kitchen, who was traveling with the maritime convoy, gave this update in remarks carried by Reuters.
Behind me, you have the open arms. You have the Litra Dynamic and you have the Jennifer. Three of the boats are going right now to the coast of Gaza with tons of food for the people of Gaza. We have the open arms and the Marshall already went, and we have the Jennifer loaded with hundreds, almost 400 tons of food. We have canned product, we have flour, rice, we have dates, and this will be arriving in the next days for the people of Gaza, specific for the people of North. We are also doing daily trucks crossing to Gaza. We have done hundreds, and we think that we need to have more routes and more ways to deliver by land. Also, we are doing airdrops, and now we are doing this because there is not enough aid arriving to Gaza, and we need to open as many ways to do this possible. This is possible thanks to the partnership that we have working together with the UAE, thanks to the government of Cyprus and all the relevant authorities and actors involved on this.
Juan Camilo, representative of World Central Kitchen. Israel says there is no food shortage in Gaza and claims to the contrary are due to Hamas's false accusations. A government spokesperson, Avi Hyman, made the remarks in an online briefing today, during which he also said that the IDF operation in Shifa Hospital will be studied in the future as the gold standard of urban warfare.
There is a stable food supply in southern Gaza. 242 packages of food carrying hundreds of thousands of meals were airdropped over northern Gaza since the start of March. An average of 140 daily food trucks have entered Gaza. Before the war, only 70 food trucks entered Gaza daily. So double the amount of food is going in than before the war. Markets are bustling. Food stocks are piled up in the aid agency warehouses. Hamas's objective is to create an image of a humanitarian crisis. Where there is hunger in Gaza, it is hunger orchestrated by Hamas. These are the images they create. These are the images they want you to see. I can guarantee three things. Number one, no one in Hamas is hungry. Number two, Hamas and other criminal and terrorist gangs steal the aid. Number three, Hamas wants to maximize the suffering of ordinary Gazans. Why? To stop the war, to protect their own skins. Today and every day, we are filling Gaza with aid by land, air, and sea. Moving on to the situation at the Shifa Hospital, I believe that the terrorist takeover of Shifa and the subsequent special forces operation to clear the hospital of terrorists will be studied by future generations of military strategists at West Point and Sandhurst as the gold standard for urban warfare. The Prime Minister confirmed, and I quote, "Our forces operated there in an exemplary fashion. Shifa has become a main terrorism command center for Hamas. The surprise action by our forces was precise and surgical."
According to Reuters, US and Israeli officials will meet today virtually to discuss the operation in Rafah. Can you confirm it? And is the meeting instead of the Israeli delegation that was supposed to visit the US?
So I can say that from day one, from the very beginning of the war, we've had close, almost daily interactions with the Biden administration, with our counterparts in America. That continues. I'm not going to speak specifically as to whether a meeting has taken place or will take place. I can just say that those channels are open, will continue to be open. America remains our strongest ally and closest of friends. And two things are clear. One, we must go into Rafah. Two, we're happy to speak to our closest ally and discuss tactics and that sort of thing. But we must go into Rafah. We are a sovereign state. There are four of the last Hamas battalions in Rafah, and they must be eliminated for the sake of the children of Gaza and for the sake of the children of Israel.
Are we closer or further away from an acceptable hostage deal for Israel? If further away from a hostage deal, as the continuation of hostage talks likely influence the decisions to launch the operation in Rafah, how imminent is this operation?
Our stated goals of the war have not changed from day one of the war. We will destroy Hamas, we will bring home every last hostage, and we will ensure that Gaza no longer poses a threat to Israel. Now, that being said, we will keep up all diplomatic channels. We will continue all diplomatic channels and do everything that we can to bring home the hostages. As my prime minister has said again and again and again, and as is actively happening. One thing we learned when we were able to enable the release of close to half of the hostages back in November was that two things do it, the carrot and the stick. Military pressure needs to be applied on Hamas. Hamas needs to be on their knees begging, please, for some respite, for a breather. That's what brought them to a deal, while the diplomatic channels were used at the same time. So we will continue. One thing doesn't rule out the other. We need to go into Rafah. We need to destroy Hamas, and the hostages need to come home. Now, let me remind you all that this war can end right now. Right now, with Hamas putting their hands in the air, waving a white flag, surrendering unconditionally to our forces, and releasing the 134 Israelis being held, men, women, children, babies. It is a crime against humanity, and there is no reason for this war to go on if they would just surrender and release the hostages.
Avi Hammond of the National Public Diplomacy Directorate. Turning to those contacts on a hostage release deal, a Khan reporter says that according to a diplomatic source, if Hamas is interested in a deal, it is possible to move forward in the coming days. Senior Israeli sources involved in the negotiations said the Israeli delegation has presented to mediators in Cairo an updated and more flexible stance on one of the main sticking points in the negotiations, the return of Palestinians to the northern Gaza Strip. According to Khan, at yesterday's war cabinet meeting, which was relatively brief, ministers decided to give the negotiators more maneuvering room in the talks in accordance with Hamas's response to the latest proposal put forward by the mediating countries. The ministers slightly expanded the team's mandate to negotiate moving forward in anticipation of Hamas's response. No decision has been made to raise the level of the delegation at this point, and the directors of the Mossad and Shin Bet security agencies are not currently scheduled to travel to Cairo. The Israel Security Agency's Shin Bet and police this morning arrested one of Ismail Haniyeh's sisters, 57-year-old Sabih Abdul Salem, a resident of Tel Sheva, for alleged security offenses, including incitement to terror on social media. She has lived for many years in Israel, and this is the first time that she's been arrested. Haniyeh, the director of Hamas's political wing, has several sisters who are married to Israeli Bedouin men, live in Tel Sheva, and have Israeli citizenship. A search of the woman's home turned up tens of thousands of shekels in cash and jewelry and extensive evidence of incitement. Haniyeh's sister allegedly was in touch with Hamas terrorists. The evidence in the police possession allegedly proves she supported the October 7th massacre and encouraged terrorists in the Gaza Strip to persist with their attacks. Her remand in custody has been extended by 3 days. Three people were seriously injured in a stabbing attack in the Gan Yavne Mall last night. The terrorist, a 19-year-old Palestinian resident of the Hebron area who was in Israel illegally, was shot dead by a police officer and a municipal inspector. The wounded, who were between the ages of 17 and 25, were taken to a Suda hospital in Ashdod. Two remained hospitalized in serious condition. A third person was wounded in the terror attack, is hospitalized in moderate condition. 6 months after the October 7th attack on southern Israel, the remains of a terrorist who took part in the massacre were discovered next to the Sderot train station. A vest with munitions was also discovered, and police sappers were summoned to neutralize the explosives in a controlled blast. The station, which only recently reopened for train service, was closed for about 2 hours. Against the backdrop of demonstrations for new elections and intensification of protests for the release of hostages, which some say have taken on a political tone, the Hostage and Missing Families Forum headquarters issued a statement today stressing that the families of the hostages represent the diverse fabric of Israeli society, unified by tragic circumstances. The forum stressed it is a nonpartisan home for all the families, transcending right or left political leanings. Its sole purpose is securing the release of the hostages. In an appeal to the prime minister, the forum said the hostages' families speak for all Israeli citizens and Jewish people who understand that redeeming captives is sacred. We ask of you, instruct the negotiating team to not return without a deal. For the murdered hostages, grant them the honor of a proper burial on Israel's soil. We are behind you. And protesters camped outside the Knesset today continued their calls for the government to reach a deal to free dozens of hostages still held in Gaza, 134, and to hold early elections. Thousands of people gathered outside the Knesset last night in the largest anti-government demonstration since the country went to war in October. Here are voices from the protest who spoke to the Associated Press today and last night. Guy Poran, Katya Armoza, Karen Saar, opposition Knesset member Gilad Kariv, and finally, Ayelet Metzger, whose father-in-law is held hostage in Gaza.
We must. We cannot imagine him not being replaced because we are, he's driving us to the abyss. We are in a place where if he's not changed, and again, if good leaders or a new coalition is not taking over, we are doomed.
I'm doing what I've been doing for the last 4 months. I'm asking politely to Mr. Netanyahu to go away. We don't have patience anymore. We have our kids that we don't know what is happening there.
We came for a sit-down that will last from today until end of day Wednesday, 3 days, to block the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. This is the last week of the parliament session because before they go on hiatus or vacation, yes, during time of war and when we still have 134 hostages still in Gaza, we came to call on them, on this government, to resign. This is a government that has failed us repeatedly from last year, that when they tried to pass the judicial overhaul on October 7th, when so many people have died and they couldn't help us. And from October 8th and on, they're still neglecting us. They passed an outrageous budget that has nothing to do with the fact that we're still at war and there's so many people who are still displaced.
This really shows that the Israeli public woke up. It is clear today, 6 months after the massacre of October 7th, that in order to win, we need new leadership. In order to bring back the hostages, we need new leadership. Israel cannot allow itself the continuation of Netanyahu's government and its coalition. We need to go to new elections.
It's all people in Israel that want Israel to stop
Prime Minister
and move and make some of them want election now. I want my father-in-law home now, so what, which way, it doesn't matter, just bring them back.
Voices from the protests. Turning to other protests, hundreds of ultra-Orthodox protesters blocked Route 4 outside Bnei Brak today during a demonstration against conscription to the military, because today is the date set as a deadline for the defense ministry to begin drafting Haredim. The protesters belong to the extremist Jerusalem faction. Some held banners reading "to jail and not the army, we will die rather than draft." The protest came on the same day that a High Court of Justice injunction came into effect, freezing financial support for Haredi Orthodox yeshiva, whose students receive annual deferrals from military service, with the defense ministry instructed to begin the process of drafting them. By March 31st, the government was supposed to have found a way to comply with a court ruling from 2017 that found the blanket military service exemptions for ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students to be discriminatory and illegal. Since then, though, the government has failed to legislate a new law to regulate the matter that would be acceptable to the court, leading to the current situation. In Jerusalem, protesters continued to gather outside the house of Shas party leader Aryeh Deri, demanding an end to the military service exemptions granted to the Haredim. Eran Etzion, a former deputy head of the National Security Council, spoke to Reuters.
We are here in front of Aryeh Deri's home. Aryeh Deri is a long-standing collaborator of Benjamin Netanyahu throughout his various governments, and he is a leader of a Haredi sect which has been disavowing its civic obligation to enlist to the IDF. While the majority of Israelis, who are obviously serving their mandatory service, have tolerated this behavior for decades, we are here to say we will no longer tolerate it. Ad kan in Hebrew, which means this is it. We are drawing a line in the sand, and we are demanding from Aryeh Deri, from his cohorts, from the entire Haredi community, to enlist to the IDF. We are at war, we need every soldier, and the days of disavowing their responsibility are over.
Eran Etzion. Opposition leader Yair Lapid called on the government to uphold the law and not try to circumvent the high court injunction. Speaking at an Yesh Atid faction meeting, Lapid said, "Do not deceive, find workarounds, or transfer concealed funds. Do not do any of the things we know they will try to do. They have to act for a change, like a government that abides by the law." The chairman of the opposition Yisrael Beitenu party, Avigdor Lieberman, meanwhile, called on all the Zionist parties in the opposition and the coalition to immediately begin a dialogue on drafting a constitution for Israel. "The current crisis is the worst in the history of the state. We cannot return to what existed before October 7th. We must write a constitution and pass a law on military service for all. We must restore for the people the sense of security and vision." Attorney General Gali Baharav Miara has informed the Defense Ministry and Education Ministry that the process of drafting members of the ultra-Orthodox community into the army must begin today. She also warned against any attempt to continue funding yeshivot that harbor students who dodge their army service against the court order. In a letter to legal advisors for both ministries, Baharav Miara and Deputy Attorney General Gil Limon noted that the state needs to tell the High Court of Justice by the end of the month what steps it is taking to draft the Haredi Orthodox community. Reporter Mark Weiss spoke with Professor Benny Brown from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and the Israel Democracy Institute and asked him about the ultra-Orthodox response to the draft decision and the cutting of funds to the yeshivot.
Most of the Haredim were quite shocked by it. Although it was quite expected for a long time, the government succeeded in prolonging the process and postponing the court decision from already a few years. And actually, when it already came, it was quite shocking for many of them. However, it's noteworthy that the Supreme Court did not decide on forceful, coercive recruitment of the Haredi yeshiva students, but rather budget cuts for their institutions. And that is kind of what we spoke about when planning the possible ways to recruit Haredi. There are two channels. One channel was the personal sanctions, some of them even criminal sanctions, such as imprisonment and the like. And others are the institutional sanctions, and this is what actually the Supreme Court opted for. So basically, this is less severe in the social, the sense of the social rift in Israel, because we won't see military or police forces coming to arrest Haredim. We'll just see a kind of reorganization of the Haredi institutions in attempt to gain their funding from other sources, which is something quite more bearable for them. They always said that most of their budgets are not from the state, and it will, of course, offend them and be a painful decrease in their incomes. But still, it's not something that will absolutely dry them up out. So they'll have to seek other sources of financing. And that is indeed a problem, because already now most of these institutions are their existence is in a quite low level in terms of material resources. But this is something that is more easy to overcome, more easy to surmount than personal sanctions, certainly than criminal sanctions. So they're still in shock. They still can't really accept this fact, but they can still, I mean, find some solace, we can say, in the fact that it is not the most severe sanction that was on the table.
Theoretically, there is, of course, another month to reach some kind of compromise before the High Court meets again on the issue. Do you think that's possible? Do you think there is wriggle room for an agreement that will please the Haredi community and some members of the Likud who feel very strongly about this, and the judicial branch as well? Is it doable?
I think that such a compromise will be only a compromise that will not hurt what they consider, the Haredim consider, as the hard core of the yeshiva world, which is, if it's something that only recruits, you know, some kinds of marginal numbers and people who are already on the margins in the sense of their Haredi commitment, that would be something more bearable for them. I doubt whether it would be sufficient for the Supreme Court, because basically we have to say the truth in that issue. Now, for example, in the Zionist religious movement, we can see a kind of overall mobilization for the campaign against the Haredim, that calling to the Haredim to join the army. But the problem is indeed severe. I mean, we speak about it all the time in terms of equal burden, things like that. But from the Haredim's point of view, it's a matter of freedom of conscience, we can call it. We usually keep, you know, our vocabulary changes when we speak about different sectors in the society. When it's leftist, we speak about freedom of conscience. With the Haredim, we speak about equal burden. But for the Haredim, it's a problem of freedom of conscience, because for them, Recruitment to the army draft is actually a means for their secularization, and they don't want to be secularized. And when the religious Zionists call and say, look at us, we can keep our religious commitment and still serve in the army and take part in the Israeli society and its duties, this is exactly what they don't want. They don't want to be like the Zionist religious. They treat them with some degradation, sometimes even contempt. They don't want to be like them. So even if the army goes a few more miles toward the Haredim, it won't meet their demands and their high standards of religious observance.
According to some commentators, there is some willingness after the terrible events of October the 7th amongst some of the Haredi population, an acceptance that what was cannot be anymore. But it's the rabbis that are taking a hardline position, blocking any potential compromise. Is that the case?
Those who think that something has changed. First of all, I think the entire Israeli society is no longer in that mood. Most of the Israeli society, left and right, actually returned to the rift and to the conflicts that preceded the October 7th. So the Haredim are not different in that sense. They were all shocked, were all united, solidified, in, you can say, under the trauma, but that we were kind of recovering in the bad sense of the word and returning to our earlier conflicts. Nothing changed in the depth of the Israeli society's internal rift. So, and Haredim are no different. And those who already were on the margin, that's what I said in my previous answer, that those who are already in a certain kind of limbo on the margins of the Haredi society are willing to regret it. Most of them did. These are only a few thousands. This didn't satisfy the Supreme Court and many others who demand the equal burden from the Haredim. I think they won't be suffice with that either. If these numbers are grow a little bit, they want something much more substantive. Sorry, in terms of Haredi recruitment. So I believe that. They could have met somewhere in the middle if the recruitment would be on those Haredim, but I don't think it will satisfy the Supreme Court.
And what about within the ultra-Orthodox community? Is there any difference between the Ashkenazi parties and Shas on this issue?
Yes, there are, but still the internal dynamics of the Haredi world is such that the more stringent position is more influential, and others do not want to be portrayed as lukewarm, as not committed enough. Basically, Shas as well doesn't want the military draft, and if they do agree to compromises, it's because it is a little more lenient and more. Aiming at, first of all, want to keep the present coalition. That is one interest that is important to all the Haredim. But also they understand that they won't get any better government in the future, and they do want to reach the compromise within this political framework. So Shas is a little more pragmatic in that sense. It also doesn't have a rabbinic leadership, not exactly in the strict sense of the word as the other parties, the Agudat Israel and the Degla Torah have. So it's easier for us, people like us, politicians like Aryeh Deri, to be pragmatic rather than the other Ashkenazi leaders who are much more subject to the rabbinic leadership, which, as you said correctly, is a little more kind of rigid in this dispute.
Finally, last night, a few hundred members of the Brothers and Sisters in Arms protest organization decided to march in Mea Shearim in Jerusalem. How did this go down?
Yes, actually, it's a provocation, it's clear. Mea Shearim is the most radical Haredi ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, the most anti-Zionist, the center of the anti-Zionist circles today. Those who do not only fight against the recruitment, but also many of them refuse to get government financing. So in that respect, it was even kind of absurd, you know, that they went there in order to convince them to be recruited when they for them the sanctions imposed by the Supreme Court are already there from their own choice. They didn't take government financing by their own choice. So to convince them, it's even more ridiculous. And it is clear that they didn't come not to they come to convince anyone, but actually kind of evoke. Resistance and evoke ugly responses, and they didn't get it so much. They did get, I mean, antagonistic reactions, but no outburst of, you know, of violence or anything like it happened there. So I think in that respect, it was a missed provocation, a kind of unsuccessful provocation.
Professor Benny Brown from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and the Israel Democracy Institute. More coming up, but first, Daniela Spector, Bahtchala, in the beginning.
Yeah.
Taking a midway look at the headlines this evening, a strike attributed to Israel near the Iranian embassy in Damascus kills several people, including a top Iranian Quds Force commander. An IDF soldier is killed in battle in the southern Gaza Strip, bringing the Israeli military war fallen to 600. The Israeli military concludes the Shiva hospital operation after killing or arresting hundreds of terror operatives. An armed drone apparently launched from Iraq infiltrates Israeli airspace, causing slight damage to a building on an Israeli naval base in the Eilat Bay area. The Knesset passes the so-called Al Jazeera law, allowing closure of foreign media outlets deemed harmful to state security. The yeshiva draft row spurs protests on both sides of the controversy, the weather outlook cooler along the coast and coastal plain, but still hot for the time of year. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to be discharged from hospital tomorrow afternoon after undergoing a hernia operation last night. His office said the prime minister feels well and continued to engage in his daily routine from the hospital, including consultations and conversations. Earlier, the prime minister's doctor, Professor Alon Pekarsky, gave this update from the Hadassah and Kerem Medical Center.
Here at the Hadassah Medical Center in Ein Kerem, the operation of the Prime Minister, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu, was completed successfully. He's awake, he's talking to his family, and his situation is perfect.
Professor Alon Pekarsky. The IDF spokesperson, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, is giving his evening briefing at this hour. In the outset of his remarks, Hagari said that the IDF and Shin Bet have concluded their focused operation in Shifa Hospital, during which some 900 terror suspects were arrested, 500 of them proven to be Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists, some including senior figures. He said that significant intelligence was culled during the operation. He said Hamas destroyed the hospital after turning it into a command center, and stressed that the Israeli military forces during the operation took special efforts to avoid any harm to the medical staff and patients. On the overnight drone infiltration in Israel's south, Hagari said that an Iranian manufactured and directed drone struck in an Israeli naval base in Eilat overnight, causing slight damage. He said that the IDF continues to probe the incident in the north. He also said that IDF forces carried out 10 near simultaneous strikes on Hezbollah sites. The Knesset has passed second and third readings of the so-called Al Jazeera law, which will grant the government temporary powers to prevent foreign news networks from operating in Israel if they are deemed by security services to be harmful to national security. The vote was 71 in favor and 10 against. The U.S. has expressed concern over passage of the legislation, which is seen as being intended at shutting down the Al Jazeera network operations in Israel. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said in response to a question at a briefing on the matter a short while ago, "We believe in the freedom of the press. It is critically important. The United States supports the critically important work journalists around the world do, and that includes those who are reporting on the conflict in Gaza. If those reports are true, it is concerning to us." Bereaved families have asked that government representatives do not speak at military cemeteries during the state ceremonies this coming Memorial Day for Israel's fallen soldiers. A Khan reporter says that some 300 families signed a letter in which they said that in light of the volatility of the matter of this year, they asked to focus on the newly bereaved families. Last year's Memorial Day was similarly tense against the backdrop of anti-government sentiment in the coalition's judiciary overhaul plan. Acclaimed Israeli author Sami Michael has died at the age of 97. Born in Baghdad, he became active in the underground communist movement in Iraq after the rise of pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic elements in the country. He was forced to flee the country in 1948 and moved to Iran before immigrating to Israel a year later. Michael's books have been translated into dozens of languages, won many awards, including the Prime Minister's Prize for Hebrew Literary Works and the Hans Christian Andersen Award. Some of his works were adapted for theater, cinema, and television. Among his best-known writings include Victoria and A Handful of Fog. In his novels, Michael presents the identity and existential conflicts of women and men, Jews and Arabs, immigrants, and members of different social classes. His rich body of work shifts in time and space, describing the 1920s and the 2000s, Baghdad to Haifa, the two central cities in his work, and frequently using biographical materials. Apart from his literary career, Michael is also known as a playwright, translator, social activist, and president of the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. President Isaac Herzog eulogized the writer as a giant among giants who made our bookshelf rich and spectacular. Trust between Israeli Arabs and Jews was severely damaged in the aftermath of the October 7th attack, with a sharp rise in negative attitudes each side holds against the other. A study by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem's Accord Center found that in January, these heightened negative attitudes remained at about the same levels, yet concerns of an explosion into violence have not been realized. We heard more from Ron Gerlitz, executive director of Accord Social Psychology for Social Change.
So I think the main findings of this research, which indeed it is a research that we conducted in few points of time before October 7th and twice after, one in the end of October and one in recent January, is that in October we saw, and it's not a surprise, a significant increase of negative emotion and attitudes between Jews and Arabs, especially among Jews towards Arabs in Israel. The level that we saw in October and is still with us in general is extremely high and very, I would say, explosive. In the January research, we would hope, I would say, to see a decrease in this negative emotion, but unfortunately, we didn't see a decrease. We see a stable situation between October and January.
So, what does that mean that it stabilized?
It means that the current state of relation is still in a dangerous situation, is still very explosive. Those high level, I can just maybe give you one number. 40% of the Jews have high level of hate towards Arabs in Israel. Those are very high numbers, and those are the kind of things that can cause explosive and violence between the groups in Israel.
And what about the attitudes within the Arab population towards the Jews? What were those concerns?
Among the Arabs, we didn't find a significant increase in our research during October and January. There can be few explanations for that. And I can say that maybe for the first time, we think that maybe Arabs were really afraid to say really what they think in this research, because Arab citizens in Israel feel a real fear from Jews in Israel and from the security services. So we are not sure that people were honest in their answers, and we have a question mark on that field of the research.
So when you're looking at these figures about this heightened state of mutual fear of the other, that's sort of, it's a complicated situation to maintain for a sustained period, especially if one is concerned about some kind of explosion.
Yes, indeed, and we should remember that many of us, right after October 7th, were afraid and projected that there will be violence between Jews and Arabs in Israel. And I think we should not take it for granted the fact that there wasn't violence, because everything was there. Such high level of negative emotions. Hundreds of thousands of Jews and Arabs meet on a daily basis in Israel without any wall between them. So much weapons on both sides. we should also remember there are people that work for and desire escalation between Jews and Arabs in Israel. Unfortunately, one of them is the Minister of Internal Security. We had like all the reason in the world, or we had like at least many reasons that we would have seen violence between Jews and Arabs in Israel. Fortunately, and I think there are some reasons that we didn't see a violence between Jews and Arabs, at least so far.
What, in your assessment, would be some of those reasons?
I think there can be two explanations. One explanation would say people are simply afraid. Jews are afraid to open like another front in addition to the Gazan one and maybe one in the north. And Arabs are just terrified from the Jews and from security services. We should remember that Arabs were arrested just to put things in, on their Facebook. So this could be one explanation. But I think there is another explanation which I believe is a stronger explanation. And it is that the processes that we saw in the Israeli society in the recent 10, 15 years of the beginning of the integration of the Arab citizens into the Israeli society and economy and academy resulted in the fact that, unlike in the past, so many Jews and Arabs meet really on a daily basis, really on a daily basis. We speak like about hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Jews and Arabs that meet in the employment market and in the health system and in the academy. And we found in our research that the fact that people have like a positive encounter with people from the other group is going together with a lower negative emotion and lower negative intention or intention to negative behavior. So it might be that the fact that we see a beginning of infrastructure in shared society in Israel served like an immune factor for eruption of Jews of violence between Jews and Arabs. This can be one factor. And another factor that since October, I would say 10, 11, we saw significant efforts by many leaders on both sides, Jewish and Arabs, side that worked very hard to avoid that violence. And I'm sure that this work and those efforts on the ground were another factor that avoided the escalation into violence.
So going forward, what might you expect to see, and do proactive steps need to be taken?
So the second question is easier. For sure, proactive steps must be taken. We are in a very high and explosive level of negative attitudes of Jews and Arabs towards each other. If we do, and by the way, it's kind of natural after what happened in October 7th and because of the war. If we do nothing about it, okay, this is the thing that can cause violence between the groups. And those things don't disappear by themselves. The Israeli system, government, education system should address the challenge of those negative perceptions. I would say, with the current government, it is extremely difficult. But all leaders in the Israeli society must address this challenge from the very simple reason. If Jews and Arabs, don't citizens in Israel, don't succeed to have, I would say, even a normal relationship, the Israeli society and economy cannot function. We have like a big, very big interest, you know, hospitals, transportation system, so many infrastructure in Israel simply cannot function if Jews and Arabs cannot work together. That's what we have a very strong interest. Going forward, I hope that we are not going into violence. So far, there is a success of the both groups, I would say. We are in extremely bad days of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But inside Israel, Jews and Arabs / Palestinian, almost 6 months succeeded to avoid violence between the groups. I think this is a success. We should work very hard to keep in this direction.
Do you think that is affected in part by a sense of shared fate or driven by a sense of fear?
I think it's more in the direction of shared faith. And I would say even more in the direction of, you know, we are here together and we need to find ways to live together. And also because I would say, how much you can hate the doctor that you take your kids when they have like something and you go to hospital, or the person that gives you services in some places. I mean, those are people that you know, that you see on a daily basis. I think that the very bad situation of dehumanization that exists between Israel and Palestinians in the general Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for sure between Israelis and Palestinians in Gaza during these days of the war, doesn't exist between Jews and Arabs in Israel. This dehumanization doesn't exist, and I think that it is more the beginning of the shared society between Jews and Arabs plays a stronger factor in the fact that we didn't see violence so far.
Ron Gerlitz, Executive Director of Accord. Before the weather and return headlines, Avraham Tal, I am Mima Freim. The days pass.
אם תלכי לי בשנייה עולמי קרוס ואם אלך לך תצטערי על הזמנים בהם היינו יחד ושתקנו הימים עוברים והשנים רצות ואיפה את ואני באמת ילדים הולכים אמהות בוכות תגידי מה פה חשוב באמת כמה נתעסק עוד בכיף וכמה נתעכב עוד על השונה ואיפה לא היינו מי שאנחנו באמת הימים עוברים והשנים רצות ואיפה את ואני באמת ילדים הולכים תגידי מה פה חשוב באמת הימים עוברים והשנים רצות ואיפה את ואני באמת ילדים הולכים אמהות בוכות תגידי מה פה חשוב
Outlook, cooler tomorrow along the coast and coastal plain, but still hot for the time of year with Shirav conditions over most of the country. Wednesday will be cooler, but still hot for the time of year. Mostly in the hills and inland, Thursday and Friday, no significant change. The temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow, Jerusalem 17 to 28, Tel Aviv 17 to 26, Haifa 20 to 26, Tzfat 19 to 25, Tiberias 16 to 34, Beersheba 20 to 32, and in Eilat from 19 degrees tonight going up to 35 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Taking another look at the headlines this evening, a strike attributed to Israel near the Iranian embassy in Damascus kills several people, including a top Iranian Quds Force commander. An IDF soldier is killed in battle in the southern Gaza Strip, bringing the Israeli military war fallen to 600. The IDF concludes the focused Shifa hospital raid after killing and arresting hundreds of terror operatives. The IDF says that the drone which hit an Eilat naval base was made in Iran and directed by Iran.
The Knesset passes the so-called Al Jazeera law, allowing closure of foreign media outlets deemed harmful to state security. The yeshiva draft row spurs protests on both sides of the controversy. The weather outlook, cooler along the coast and coastal plain, but still hot for the time of year. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. Watch our 2 p.m. newsflash on the Kan English Facebook page. Find us on Spotify, X, or write to us at kanenglish@kan.org.il. Together with sound engineer Michael Olschwang, this is Nomi Segal wishing you good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.